طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. This week we have a full program, so we will get right to our feature presentation, which is a continuation of our coverage of the conference held at UMass Amherst on November 12, 2019. This week we hear Tim Wise, Cornel West, and Dimi Khalidi, all introduced by Linda Sarsour. So here we go.
Let's get the show on the road. I am so deeply honored to introduce to all of you to the podium Tim Wise, who is an American anti-racism activist, a writer, a trainer. My list of white men that I love very much is quite short, and Tim Wise makes that list. He is actually the true embodiment of allyship and using his privilege to talk about issues of race and racism. And he makes other white people feel really uncomfortable, and I enjoy watching it. So please give it up to Tim Wise.
Thank you so much. It is a huge honor to be here at UMass, and I want to thank all the folks that made this event possible and included me in it. I was trying to think of what my unique contribution would be this evening, and I decided, given the Chancellor's comments before this event and surrounding controversy around the event, that I would take my time to speak to this matter, not merely as someone who has certainly studied the Palestine-Israel conflict and the surrounding issues, but more importantly, as a Jew who is incredibly tired of being told by other people, whether Jews and certainly when Gentiles, what anti-Semitism is, and being told, whether by Jews or other Gentiles, what self-aiding Judaism is. I have been Jewish a long-ass time. I've been Jewish for 51 years. I've been white just as long. I know the Nazis don't think those two things are possible together because they are Nazis. I am not speaking to you. But I am suggesting that when you were on this earth as someone who is Jewish for 51 years, you will have experience with actual anti-Semitism, and you will know the real thing from the imposter thing. And I don't need anyone to tell me what attacks the dignity of Jewish people, as your chancellor suggested this event somehow does, right? Because my family and I have a long history of having our dignity attacked, not by Muslims, not by Palestinians, not by supporters of BDS, not by critics of Israel, but by good Christian men like Mike Pence, who insist that Jews like me will burn in a lake of fire for all eternity until we stop being Jews. That is the ultimate in anti-Semitic invective. That is the ultimate anti-Jewish bigotry. That is the ultimate in the attack on the dignity of Jewish people. And yet we got folks in this country that suck up to that nonsense, even though those folks say, oh, I love Israel, and they say, I support Zionism and I oppose BDS, but they believe that your Judaism makes your soul an empty vessel, totes to hell with them, and to hell with anybody that throws down with them. And I would suggest to you that if you were someone who believes that Jews are inferior spiritually, your views on Israel are of no consequence to me and ought not be of any consequence to anyone who actually cares about the well-being of Jewish people anywhere on the planet, in this country or anywhere else. My great-grandfather was run out of Russia by actual anti-Semites. My father's Jewish community center was bombed by actual anti-Semites in 1957. My temple Had Klansmen drive up onto the driveway when I was 13 years old, attempt to bomb it and to kill my rabbi. When I got out of college, the first thing I did was fight against David Duke, an actual Nazi, an actual anti-Semite, when he ran for the U.S. Senate and governor in Louisiana, for which we had constant death threats. Last December, my family, my children, my wife, myself were the victims of constant harassment, death threats, people coming to our house, calling our house, texting us on a regular basis, threatening to kill us all. Actual anti-Semites, not one of them Muslim, not one of them Palestinian, not one of them a supporter of BDS, not one of them a critic of Israel, all of them doing so in the name of good, God-fearing Christianity and white supremacy. So I do not need your chancellor, and I do not need anyone else to tell me what anti-Semitism is. Let me be very clear. If there is anything that attacks the dignity of Jews, it is the kind of thing that many of us who are Jewish were raised on that actually encouraged us to shut down this discussion before any state tried to ban it, before any campus tried to ban it. We censor ourselves. And I know this because today before I live in Nashville. So not only am I Jewish, y'all, I'm from Nashville, y'all. So the struggle is real. When you are Jewish in Nashville, where like every four-way stop there are three churches, right? And like the fourth corner is like a Walgreens or whatever the hell, but like, and every pastor is telling you that you're going to hell in between trying to get their record deal. So, you know, the struggle is real. But as I was leaving Nashville today, I looked up on my bookshelf in my home office and I found a book from my eighth grade Hebrew school class. Now, it's an old-ass book, y'all. I was in eighth grade in 1981. In 1982, this book was written in 1980, but I brought it with me because there's a passage in here that I think symbolizes the way that we who are Jews have silenced ourselves on these important matters for too long. It isn't just about other people trying to silence criticism of Israel, trying to silence support for BDS, or trying to silence criticism of Zionism itself. It is what we do. So here's what I was taught as a child, because the propaganda runs deep and it works. It does a number on us, and we do this to ourselves. So this book that I was asked to read when I was 13 years old, called Great Jewish Debates and Dilemmas, the subtitle is Jewish Perspectives on Moral Issues in Conflict in the 80s. All right, so dude needs an editor, first off. That's a long title. But this book, by the way, was published by the publishing arm of Reform Judaism, right, which at that time was the most liberal, you know, sort of house of Judaism within the United States. There was Reconstructionism wasn't really a thing yet. It was sort of Reform was like, these were the liberal folks, right? And so you go through this book and there's Jewish perspectives on everything, abortion, Jewish perspectives on taxes, Jewish perspectives on immigration, Jewish perspectives on gun control. And there are all kinds of differences, right? There's like a debate that they present in here. But you get to the section on Israel, Zionism, and the Jewish people. Here's the first paragraph. You want to understand how we got to where we are right now? Here's where the first paragraph comes in. It says, if we Jews have one commitment which suffers no ambivalence, if we have one bond which unifies each and every one of us, it is our profound solidarity with the people and the state of Israel. We may differ about God and religion, politics and education, but on Israel, we are solidly united. All Jews consider themselves Zionist. And then this section goes on to say, our self-esteem, our very self-identification is tied to the fate of Israel. Diaspora survival is linked to Israel's survival in the minds of most Jews. See, when you lay it out like that, and when you say that we all agree, I remember there, I have question marks in the margin that I wrote when I was 12, y'all. And 13, I was like, what? Nobody polled me. Nobody asked me. The rabbi was coming around taking up my tzedakah money, telling me that I was giving this money so that we could plant trees in somebody else's olive grove. And I was like, why are we doing that? And they were like, you don't need to ask these questions. Just read this book, see? And we're all united. But when you suggest that the debate even internally is not acceptable, when you say, because what this is a family telling you that they will disown you if you speak out. That's what that is. That is a family telling you they will withhold love from you if you do not go. That is abuse. And we would see it as such in any other capacity. That attacks the dignity of Jewish people, not this forum. Right? Actually, suggesting that those of us who were Jews must act as automatons devoid of ability or the need to question things. And the irony of shutting down questioning around Israel and even around Zionism itself, shutting down questioning and inquiry is like the least Jewish thing you can do, y'all. Like, the one thing I know about Judaism, I've forgotten a lot, you know, because I'm like a militant agnostic, which I know is like a contradiction in terms, because agnostics are like, you know, whatever. But one thing that I remember very well about Judaism, Judaism is predicated on inquiry and questioning and debate. If you've read the Talmud is basically a bunch of rabbinical scholars got together to try to work some shit out. And they're arguing amongst themselves. And if you read it, it's completely contradictory. It is completely inconsistent because there are all these different opinions being shared. It's like if you were just taking the minutes of a meeting of a bunch of rabbinical scholars and some dude in the corner is like, how about this? And somebody else is like, that's the craziest thing I ever heard of. How about this? That's Jewish teaching and Talmudic learning. It is about inquiry. It is about question. It is about dissent. And so to suggest that questioning our particular stance vis-a-vis Israel, both the government of and Zionism as a political movement, is incredibly anti-Jewish. That assaults the dignity of Jewish people, not this forum. In fact, here's another irony. Shutting down that inquiry feeds the very stereotypes upon which anti-Semites prosper. Right? Because what are the stereotypes about our people? Right? Our stereotypes about our people are, well, you're very clannish, and you all stick together, and you only care about what's good for the Jews, and it's almost like a conspiracy to run the world. And then Jews are like, we're not going to ever allow dissent within our own community because to do so is anti-Semitic. That feeds the very notion of clannishness. It feeds the very idea that we don't care about the rights and humanity of other people. And that's not to say that we're to blame for the anti-Semitism when it happens, but when we feed into that mindset by not questioning, I can assure you, that there are actual anti-Semites, actual modern Nazis, who take great pleasure in that. And I know this because I get letters from them, messages from them, tweets from them all the time. They haven't done their homework because, like, I don't know, like, Nazis or us, research department sort of sucks, I guess. So they don't, like, use Google effectively. So they haven't actually done their homework on me, but they know I'm Jewish. They're like, what about Israel? What about, you know, the treatment of Palestinians? What about laws that provide Jews greater opportunity to buy land in Israel than those who were non-Jews? What about laws against intermarriage? What about, like I don't, A, know this stuff, and B, haven't condemned it, right? And then when you do, as a Jew, speak out against those things, they have no response. These white supremacists, these neo-Nazis, these white nationalists, these anti-Semites are not prepared for Jews who are prepared to criticize that which we do. Right? And when we stand tall in solidarity with Palestinian people, it knocks those Nazis off balance. It knocks actual anti-Semites off balance. And it proves that we are not of one mind, except insofar as we believe in justice and will damn sure fight for it. That is the only thing that we have to insist upon. One last thing. If anything attacks the principles of Jewish dignity, I'm going to suggest, and I've felt this way for a long time, and I am perfectly willing to debate the subject. That's the point, right? Debate and inquiry. If you want to argue against BDS, argue against BDS. If you want to argue in favor of Zionism, argue in favor of Zionism. If you want to argue in favor of the Netanyahu government, good luck with that, but, you know, do your thing, right? Feel free to do whatever it is you want to do, but argue the point rather than trying to shut it down. See, my argument would be that many of the founding principles upon which Israel is based, and many of the philosophical principles of Zionism itself, are things that we ought to be willing as Jews to debate and to question. And I want to encourage everyone in this room who is Jewish to be bold enough and brave enough to do it, because it was Theodor Herzl who said this. It was Theodor Herzl who said, the founder, the philosophical founder of political Zionism, it was he who said that anti-Semitism was, quote, an understandable reaction to Jewish defects. That was not David Duke who said that. That was not Adolf Hitler who said that. That was the philosophical father of modern Zionism and the Jewish state. And then if I were to ask you who said this, each country can only absorb a limited number of Jews if she doesn't want disorders in her stomach. Germany already has too many Jews. Now, you might be inclined to think that was Hitler who said that, or someone in his government who said that. I assure you it was not. It was Chaim Weizmann who said that. At the time, he was with the World Zionist Organization. He would later become the president of Israel. That is a Jew telling the rest of the world that we are a problem and that we bring hatred upon ourselves, that we will never be safe because we are hated and hunted because we deserve it. What is self-hate exactly? Is it this panel? Is it BDS? Is it criticism of Israel? Is it criticism of Zionism? Or is it the founding principles of Zionism itself? So if you want to debate the merits of these issues, by all means, feel free. But as Jews, we must be free to demand open inquiry, open debate, both for the sake of the Palestinian people and for the sake of ourselves, the future of this country when it comes to politics, and the globe when it comes to politics and human rights depend on that. So as a Jew, I implore you to support not only BDS, but more importantly, at the very least, to support the debate around this. And if you want to argue the points, argue them. But to suggest that this is an anti-Semitic movement, to argue that this violates the dignity of Jews as Jews when there are actual people out there who would hunt us and hate us into oblivion, is an obscenity. And I thank you all so much for having me.
I heard these words once. Empathy is not simply a matter of trying to imagine what others are going through, but having the will to muster enough courage to do something about it. And these words have inspired me ever since. They are the words of a brilliant scholar, a freedom fighter, a truth teller, everybody in the movement's big, big brother, the wonderful, fabulous, I can't even think of all the great words I want to say about this man. Dr. Cornel West.
Oh, what a blessing to be here, University of Massachusetts Amherst. What an honor, what a privilege. I want to begin by saluting my dear brother Jolly. Where's Brother Jolly? Oh, what a visionary leader. Give it up for that brother. 35 years. I don't know where he is, but he's somewhere out there. He's somewhere out there. I want to salute my dear brother Omar. That was 2:30 in the morning there in the Middle East. Give it up for Brother Omar. He's my dear brother. Sister Linda, Sister Dima, Brother Sean, Brother Tim. We are here to say first and foremost that we will not cave in. We will not sell out. We will not back down. We are fundamentally committed to this, to well-being of human beings, no matter where they are, be they on the West Bank, be they in Gaza, be they, yes, in Tel Aviv. We're concerned with everybody, but we got a critique of occupation. We got a critique of any form of domination that loses sight of the humanity of others. Is that right? Is that right? And I simply come by here to say that I'm just one small voice of a great tradition of a grand people who've been terrorized for 400 years and taught the world so much about freedom. Frederick Douglass is no joke, and Harriet Tubman is no joke either. Their voices matter even here in 2019. We're here to keep their legacy alive. That's what solidarity is all about. That's what raising our voices is all about. I come from a people who have been hated for 400 years and taught the world so much about love. And I'm here because I want to stay on a love train. I could play a little John Coltrane, Love Supreme for you and back up a bit. A little Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. Or some Witness from Martin Luther King Jr. Or some novels called Beloved by Toni Morrison. Or the Love Soak essays of a genius from Harlem who taught at this grand institution, James Baldwin, the son of Harlem. It goes on and on and on and on. And I simply want to say, I've got four fundamental questions. Raise raised by the greatest public intellectual in the history of the American Empire. His name is W.B. Du Bois. His papers deposited right here by my dear brother Herbert Abdicker. And Du Bois had four questions for any generation concerned about the quest for truth, the quest for goodness, the quest for beauty, and the struggle for freedom. How shall integrity face oppression? How do we talk about integrity in such a way that we're honest and we are willing to be self-critical? The Socratic legacy of Athens, the prophetic legacy of Jerusalem, that noble discontent, that critical discontent that sits at the very center of any conception of education. And by education, I mean what the Greeks call paideia, P-A-I-D-E-I-A. That's different than cheap schooling. That's my message to your chancellor today. That any chancellor ought to be committed to Socratic energy. Any chancellor ought to be committed to robust and uninhibited conversation. Any chancellor ought to recognize that the quest for truth, capital T, is one in which none of us possess that full truth, capital T. But I come from a people whose anthem is what? Lift every voice. Lift every voice. It doesn't say lift every echo. And we don't want echo chambers. Yes, we've got disagreements. Yes, we've got a whole host of contestations and conflicts. Our dear brother Bernie, who I did love very much. Strongest position when it comes to the humanity of Palestinians and the humanity of Jews. He and I disagree on PDS. I think he's wrong. I think he thinks I'm wrong. I still love the brother. We still work together. But I'm in solidarity with the Palestinians to the degree to which when I hear their voices say, Brother West, this is our last nonviolent chance. This is the last nonviolent strategy and tactic, given the misery that we're living in, given the unbelievable oppression we're coming to terms with. Please don't allow our humanity to be rendered invisible. And I can hear Socrates saying the unexamined life is not worth living, and Malcolm X saying the examined life is painful. I can hear Amos saying, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I can hear Esther saying, here I stand. I can hear Jesus and Muhammad saying together, keep track of the least of these. I don't care if they're Palestinians. I don't care if they're in Kashmir. I don't care if they're in Tibet. I don't care if they're in Sub-Saharan Africa. I don't care if they're Dalits in India. I don't care if they're white poor in Appalachia. I don't care if they're black folk in Harlem or Chicago. What kind of human beings do you really want to be? That's the question that we're wrestling with right here. What kind of human beings do you really choose to be in the short time in your trek from your mama's womb to tomb? That's a question for the students. Because every generation has to come to terms with the question that Dostoevsky raised, and it was his birthday yesterday at 198 years old. Dostoevsky said, how you gonna come to terms with the massive suffering, the structures of domination, the hatred, the envy, the resentment that characterizes so much of we human primates given our history? And lo and behold, here come the forces of conformity, complacency, cowardliness. Look at line 24a of Plato's Apology, where Socrates says, the cause of my unpopularity was parhesia, P-A-R-R-H-E-S-I-A. And that means frank speech, fearless speech, unintimidated speech, free speech. Those who raise their voices in fearless speech, unintimidated speech, not in a narcissistic, self-righteous way, but concerned about others. That's why talking about love is not mamby-pamby stuff. Harry Belafonte, you understand, just wrote that wonderful foreword to my sister's book. It's a steadfast commitment to others, especially those who are like orphans, those who are like fatherless, motherless, persecuted, oppressed, hated, and despised. And one of the difficulties of this particular situation is you got our precious Jewish brothers and sisters, hated, despised, devalued, oppressed, attacked for 2,000 years with underdog mentality, and now find themselves in a top dog status and losing sight of their own underdogs, the precious Palestinians who are just as precious as the Jewish brothers and sisters. I'm here to remind us that a Palestinian baby has exactly the same value and significance as a precious Jewish baby. And a Jewish baby has precisely the same significance and value as a Palestinian baby. So when we hear 551 Palestinian babies who have been killed, there ought to have been voices of righteous indignation put forward in every corner of the nation, every nook and cranny of the empire. And if not, that's a sign of just how spiritually empty we are, because it's a sign of our callousness toward the suffering of Palestinians. It's a sign of our indifference toward the suffering of our Palestinians. And my dear brother, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, reminds me, indifference to evil is more insidious than evil itself. And that's part of what we're wrestling with. But the chancellor talked about, we don't stay in contact with the humanity of the Israeli side. Have you looked at the history of the voices of the PDS movement? Did you hear our brother talk honestly about there's nothing Jewish about mistreating and dominating and occupying and subjugating Palestinians? That's a human choice of Jewish brothers and sisters of a certain political and ideological orientation. We got Noam Chomsky. We got a whole wave of Jewish brothers and sisters who choose to stay in contact with the humanity of Palestinian brothers and sisters. Don't put that construct up there and somehow talk about Jews as if there's some block, some homogeneous block. No, they're human beings who choose. If you are a Jewish right-wing racist, you choose to be a racist. You choose to lose sight of the humanity of Palestinians. And so it is on the underside. If we got some Palestinian brothers and sisters who are hating Jewish brothers and sisters, we call it into question. They're choosing that, but they're hating the domination. They're hating the occupation. Absolutely. And rightly so. And within the PDS movement, just like a jazz orchestra, this is no military band of unanimity. This is a heterogeneous movement, a variety of different voices. I love my dear brother Omar to death. I don't agree with everything, even though most of it I do. That's not the point. I don't agree with everything with Bernie. I don't agree with everything with my mama. And I love her and take a bullet in the heart. But I'm tilting in a certain direction. And there's no doubt that the various establishment, right-wing, conservative, neoliberal, and too many of our progressive comrades don't want to raise their voices when it comes to Palestinian suffering. Why is that? We are calling you out too. You don't have to be so scared. You don't have to be so intimidated. Straighten your back up and take a stand in the name of integrity, honesty, decency, courage, the four questions Du Bois was talking about. So that when they, in fact, come to your funeral and your body's in the coffin, they're not going to talk about your curriculum vitae. They're not going to talk about how much money you made. They're not going to talk about how many trophy spouses you were with. They're not going to talk about the mansions that you inhabited. They're going to talk about what kind of human being were you. Did you exemplify integrity, honesty, decency, and courage? Did you take a stand on behalf of those peoples whose precious babies and men and women are being assaulted, attacked, whose homes are being bulldozed, whose land is being taken? And let us be clear, and I'll sit down. Let us be very clear. If there were a Palestinian occupation of precious Jewish brothers and sisters, there would be a mass movement of PDS, and rightly so. I would be a part of it because I believe in the primacy of the moral and the spiritual. I'm in solidarity with human beings. I don't care what color, religion, sexual orientation, or gender. And given the fact that there isn't such silence given a vicious Israeli occupation of Palestinians, we not only see the double standard, we not only see the moral hypocrisy, hypocrisy, but we also see the spiritual emptiness of a late capitalist civilization obsessed with greed and money and status and spectacle and image, making it, rather than keeping faith with something bigger than you. That's what we're wrestling with. And that's why we're getting the creeping fascism, not just in the American Empire, but in various parts of the world, in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America. That the moral catastrophe, the spiritual catastrophe, the political dysfunctionality, the rule of big military, big money, the scapegoating of the most vulnerable, that is the makings of a fascist globe in various ways. And this is part of the struggle to say no. This is part of the struggle to say we will go down swinging in this context with our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters, but in a variety of other contexts, we're going to hold up a bloodstained banner of integrity, honesty, decency, and courage. And yes, we're going to fight the establishment that will tell the lies about what has been going on since 1948 and what has been going on since 1964. Why are you so afraid of the truth? Why you don't want to come to terms with what it is to be a settler colonial regime? Why is it that you don't want to come to terms with your relation with an empire? We must be concerned about our precious Jewish brothers and sisters who feel as if their backs are against the wall, who jumped out of the burning buildings of Jew-hating Europe and landed on land where somebody else was there alongside other Jews, and they had a choice. They could go with Albert Einstein. They could go with Judah Magnus and say, we will coexist. Or they could go with Jabotinsky and say, we will dominate and we will create any means in which these Palestinians are subordinated and degraded. Right now, the legacy of Jabotinsky reigns in Israel, and we have to be honest and candid about that, and we have to raise our voices. It's a beautiful movement to see so many young Jewish brothers and sisters breaking from their parents and their grandparents and say, you've been lying to me. I'm concerned about the truth. You've been telling me all this talk about the prophetic tradition, and yet when it comes to Palestinians, you want me to remain silent. Lo and behold, I've got a new vision. I've got new energy. I've got a new way of being in the world that leads toward a solidarity with all the human beings who are concerned with those Frantz Fanon called the wretched of the earth. Do we have what it takes? I don't know, but I can tell you I'm going down swinging like Ella Fitzgerald and Muhammad Ali.
I want to introduce to the stage a very brilliant and powerful woman. One of the reasons many of our student groups, particularly groups on campuses that support Palestinian rights, professors, activists, and speakers like ourselves, feel really bold, because I'm like, when we go down, Dima's going to come figure out how to represent us. So please welcome to the stage Dima Khalidi, who's the co-founder and director of Palestine Legal. She is a brilliant attorney. She used to work at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and every day she wakes up to defend our rights to stand up in these college campuses and speak truth to power in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Good evening. It really is amazing to be here, and damn, look at my co-panelists over there. This is such a courageous and committed, and they are just unwavering justice warriors, and it is so humbling to be among them and among all of you today. Thank you so much, MEF, SUT, for making this happen again. And I obviously, people care about this. This auditorium is full. There is energy, and hopefully we'll go home organized, more organized and with better plans. What I want to do is give a little bit of a background to this conversation to show not only how widespread the attacks on the Palestine movement are, but also to show how they fit into a wider story of growing attacks on all of our rights to organize and to dissent. I just want to start with a story of a recent incident that we at Palestine Legal have been dealing with. A young Palestinian-American student at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, down in southern Illinois, recently gave a presentation as part of her role as a multicultural advocate in a program that was intended to, you know, give diverse perspectives about social justice issues. And her presentation was about Palestine, and specifically about Gaza's Great March of Return. And it highlighted 70 years of Palestinian resistance. So it was gave a history of the Palestinian struggle, of human rights abuses against Palestinians. It very carefully defined what anti-Semitism was, what anti-Zionism was. It defined all of the terms that she was using, including apartheid. And it painted a picture of what life was like for Palestinians in Gaza. A few housing staff at the university saw this, and within days there was school-wide upheaval. A resident assistant filed a complaint about the presentation, and the chancellor, this might sound familiar, sent a school-wide email that condemned the presentation as anti-Semitic. Now, a couple days earlier, swastikas had been found in dorms. So the email, in one line, condemned those and said that the school was investigating it. And in several paragraphs after that, went on and on about this presentation and how it offended people and how the university didn't tolerate anti-Semitism and all of the remedies that it would take in response. Trainings, investigations, rethinking this whole multicultural advocate program. Pro-Israel groups complained about it. A right group called Stand With Us said that the swastikas found on campus, along with several other attacks on Jewish symbols like mezuzahs on doors, paled in comparison to the presentation. The swastikas paled in comparison to a Palestinian-American student's presentation about her people's oppression. And Stand With Us, along with other pro-Israel groups, encouraged the university to adopt this redefinition of anti-Semitism that Omar referenced, basically labeling any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. Now, this is not criminalization, but it is the precursor. This kind of condemnation by public officials as something that's inherently morally reprehensible or bad is what's needed in order for the next step of criminalization to happen, of punishment, of censorship. This is the kind of attack we see every day at Palestine Legal, of course. It's the targeting of Palestinians and their allies who are speaking the truth about what's happening on the ground, what has happened to them and their families, about Palestinians' lived realities of military occupation and second-class citizenship and apartheid-like conditions, about their dispossession, about being strangers in their own land and being criminalized for resisting it. We're distracted from even talking about these issues, about these realities and the truths that we know as Palestinians, Because every time we speak up, we have to respond to these accusations that our real motivation is that we're anti-Jewish. Not that we care about Palestinians or their rights, or anybody else's, for that matter. And that's the point. It's to silence our ability to talk for ourselves, to tell our own stories. We're distracted, we're intimidated, we're made examples of, we're exhausted, our resources are exhausted, and we have to worry more about what we say, about how what we say affects our oppressors, than about what's happening in Palestine. I want to give a little bit of context about why this is happening and how. These attacks on the Palestinian rights movement are not happening in a vacuum, and I think the intro gave a little picture of this already. But these are part of a concerted, widespread effort to undermine and destroy this movement. Since 2014, Palestine Legal has responded to about 1,500 incidents of suppression. And that's just a fraction of what many of you have probably experienced when you speak out. These incidents have included lawsuits, like against the American Studies Association for passing a resolution endorsing an academic boycott, like against Professor Rabab Abdelhadi, who, because of her strong voice and her scholarship on Palestine, has been relentlessly attacked. And she went through years defending a lawsuit. These kinds of things drain us. They use our resources, and they distract us from the real work. They've included professors getting fired for, like Stephen Salaita did at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, for tweeting about the massacre of kids in Gaza in 2014. They include students being investigated and punished for protesting and doing, you know, mock checkpoints on their campuses to show their peers what it's like to live under a military occupation. They've included public institutions like libraries and universities and museums canceling events because there were complaints that it would be too biased or too offensive. And they've included widespread surveillance of activists, like Omar mentioned. Not only does Canary Mission profile thousands of students and professors, but we have, at the recent NSJP conference, National for Students for Justice in Palestine, there were people taking pictures of everybody going in and out and posting on the internet horrible things about them, and resulting in more attacks and death threats and rape threats. This is what it means to speak out for Palestinian rights today. You are vulnerable to this kind of relentless harassment, and it's often anonymous. And we see, of course, FBI agents knocking on doors and asking people about their activism. And, of course, on top of all of these various tactics that are being used, we have a wide-ranging legislative assault happening. 27 states now have laws that punish in one way or another boycotts for Palestinian rights. Of course, we know Massachusetts legislators are trying for the third time to introduce an anti-boycott bill. And we're also expecting a new wave of legislation that tries to redefine anti-Semitism for use in investigations of campus activists that allege anti-Semitic discrimination. All of this legislation has real consequences for people. Anti-boycott laws have resulted in the loss of jobs and opportunities for people like Bahia Amawi, the Palestinian-American speech pathologist in Texas, who, when she went to sign a contract for maybe the ninth year, all of a sudden she saw a certification. She had to sign something that said said, I won't boycott Israel. I don't and I won't boycott Israel in order to have this job. And she refused. And she sued. And she's winning. And that's fantastic. We're seeing courts striking down these laws slowly, but these battles take forever. And we cannot rely on the courts. And beyond these real consequences, the chilling effect is enormous. And that's what's really the intent that is really behind the laws. It's to use them to shut us up, to confuse us. Is this criminal? Am I allowed to boycott? People come to us with these questions every day. What does it mean that our legislators are saying that boycotts are this and boycotts are that? So it's important to understand that all of these efforts are being encouraged, they're being facilitated, they're being funded with tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars, not just by Israel, but by dozens of Israel advocacy groups here. And we have armies ready to attack anyone who utters the word Palestine or BDS. The other context that's important is that this is a global problem. And I think Omar mentioned that. The kind of censorship we're seeing in Germany after its parliament passed a resolution saying that BDS is anti-Semitic. Artists are being denied prizes. Talib Kweli was disinvited from a music festival because he refused to renounce BDS. In France, activists are being criminally prosecuted for engaging in BDS campaigns. What's happening in France and Germany and other countries in Europe is really the logical and the intended conclusion of what Israel and its allies are working towards here as well. Government sanctioned censorship and punishment of Palestinian rights advocacy. We have to understand that that is the aim. They don't want us to talk. They don't want us to organize. They don't want us to expose what's happening. And the other piece of context that is really critical is that we're not just talking about anti-boycott laws. We're talking about an enormous attack on our right to dissent across the board. We've seen 16 states that have enacted anti-protest legislation. Many of these laws are imposing actual criminal penalties and fines on protesters. And these movements that are being attacked are, you know, indigenous rights movements, climate justice movements, racial justice movements. These include so-called critical infrastructure bills that criminalize indigenous and environmental activists' resistance to pipelines and the protection of water and indigenous land and resources. So-called free speech laws that are weaponizing the First Amendment to protect far-right speakers from student protests on campuses. Not exactly what I think the First Amendment was intended to do, which was to protect us from the government's censorship, not from our own protests. And of course, we see the FBI labeling the Black Lives Matter movement and the movement for Black Lives, Black Identity Extremists. So in this era, with these right-wing agendas as ascendant, our rights to dissent, to protest, to collectively rise up against all of these injustices are being sacrificed to protect the status quo of white supremacy and corporate power. This is what we're up against. This attack is also not happening outside of history. And that's really important to remember as well. In our history, it's a matter of course that dissenters and popular or unpopular social justice movements have been targeted by the government. From communists in the 40s and 50s with McCarthyite witch hunts, to the civil rights and black power movements of the 60s and 70s and the anti-war movement, people calling for revolutionary, radical change have been mercilessly attacked, assassinated, surveilled, infiltrated, as was the American Indian movement and the Chicano power movement. This is not an anomaly. Let's be clear. The difference with the Palestinian rights movement here is that it's not the U.S. government that's been leading the crusade. It's been private pro-Israel groups pressuring the U.S. government. And they've failed a lot. They actually have. But with an administration now that is so fundamentally anti-Palestinian, with the staunchest Zionists in the highest of positions, and a Christian Zionist base with enormous influence, we're seeing the state increasingly take up this suppression, heeding the calls through legislation, through surveillance, through investigations into Palestine advocacy. And it's part and parcel of a widespread attack on the left, where the real and the deadly anti-Semitism of the far-right white nationalist movements is given a pass. And the human rights advocacy of the left is posited as the biggest threat to Jewish communities. This is the narrative that we're hearing. The swastikas pale in comparison to an educational presentation about Palestine. I want to also be clear that all of this is happening because we are winning. We're winning. And we're winning because we're organizing at the grassroots, and we're organizing across movements. And the youth are leading the way, SJP. And as Omar said, the Palestinian call for BDS has been taken up by churches and unions and student governments and athletes and authors and singers. Now, as an example, the University of Illinois students, they weren't having it. They weren't having the mass mail. They weren't having this complete conflation of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. They weren't having the university ignoring the real racism happening on campuses. And they've been organizing for weeks. SJP made a list of demands calling for the chancellor to apologize, to issue a new statement clearly distinguishing between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, to institute trainings not just about anti-Semitism, but about anti-black racism and queerphobia and Islamophobia, as well as anti-Semitism. And 15 other student groups, from the Black United Front to Jewish Voice for Peace to environmental justice groups to Latinx groups to socialist and Arab and Muslim groups, signed on to these demands. And hundreds of students attended teach-ins and protests, and they threatened to do a sit-in at the chancellor's office. And then they got a resolution passed in the student government endorsing their demands and demanding that the university issue an apology. This is the kind of organizing that it takes. This shows how students are leading the way with their unapologetic and their bold demands. And they're able to do this because they've been organizing for years with other students on other social justice issues, educating and mobilizing each other. This didn't happen overnight. These students have been at college learning and organizing. That's what it's for. And it's clear that this intersectional work and the solidarity that has grown between movements is the biggest threat. Israeli officials have said point blank that the major problem with Israel is the young generation of the black community. Clearly, the immense backlash that Black intellectuals and activists who speak out for Palestinian rights, from Mark Lamont Hill to Angela Davis to Michelle Alexander. It's a result of how much weight such solidarity holds, how much it clarifies the answer if you believe in equality and justice and human dignity for all. The truth is that there's no BDS or terrorist boogeyman whose demise will bring the rest of the movement crashing down. This is a decentralized, a grassroots, and intersectional movement that understands that Palestinian freedom is bound up with the freedom of oppressed and marginalized people everywhere. This is why it's possible for Massachusetts to again defeat this anti-boycott legislation. A 100 grassroots activist groups joined the last two times and defeated it. And we can win these fights, even in these forums where we don't historically have power. The last point I want to make is that we are winning, but as Sean alluded to, we're outnumbered and we're definitely out-resourced. And perhaps we need better plans as well. And things are really likely to get worse for all of us. So it's imperative that we continue to organize, to speak out, to defy these odds. Organizations like ours, PALLEGAL, is here to help and to tackle the legal threats against this movement, to protect folks from the attacks. But in order for us to see not only Palestinian freedom, but also Black and Brown freedom and Indigenous freedom and environmental justice, etc., we have to have each other's backs. We have to lift each other up. We have to show up. Ultimately, we have protection in our numbers. 1,600 sold-out crowd, that's a big number. We have protection in our principled and unwavering commitment to freedom and justice and equality for everyone without exception. We have strength in our clear rejection of racism, xenophobia, transphobia, homophobia, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and the white supremacy that is fueled by all of this hatred. So if we have all in this room, if we all stand firm and stay loud and show our collective power, we can and we will win.
You have been listening to Tim Wise, Cornel West, and D.V. Colody speaking at the UMass Amherst Conference on Criminalizing Dissent. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.